neat. I'm glad to see that our dialer is really slow. And so I'm just going to talk over that silly business. But this is where we bring you guys the news, facts, and analysis that you need to fight against the liberal media propaganda, of which there is a lot. And it's getting worse and worse. And we're going to discuss some of that and all of that, actually, today, with a lot of different stuff that's been going on. But first, what I'm doing right now is I'm making sure that we get everything out there. We're up on Facebook. We're up on YouTube, where you guys can go ahead and comment. You can also call in live at 646-668-2563. That's our Voice of America hotline, where you can have your opinions out there. We'd love to talk to you. We'd love to discuss with you and see what's going on, because we want to get your opinion. If I could get the chat box to behave, that would be fantastic, but it's not just yet, so it's okay. I will get to you folks there on YouTube. I know that everybody has probably a lot to say, because there's been a lot that was going on. Primarily, the first one I want to bring up is that there was potentially a strike against Iran, and then a decision against that strike against Iran. But the media, as they are wont to do, lied, and I don't know a better way to say it. They lied, and then they tried to cover up their lie. The initial reports that came out in regards to what was going on with Iran, is the way that it was portrayed in the media was, oh my gosh, Donald Trump was going to strike Iran, and then at the last minute, he pulled back. And I don't know how much the average person knows about the military, how these things work, but that is certainly not how those things work. It's
how do they work?
So what occurs is we already have a plan on striking Iran. We have a plan on striking many countries. There's a way in which that we would do this. If something were to escalate,
right,
then blank. That's how those plans work. Now, what will happen?
And just to give some context, there's an entire, the reason you have a general staff as part of your governmental structure, the reason that was ever developed and included was so that there would be a group of people sitting around constantly developing a essentially plan of attack or defense for multiple contingencies.
Exactly.
And there are people doing, there are generals in the Pentagon whose sole job is just, for whatever your region is, come always be having a plan of action that is constantly being updated based on the latest intelligence assessments. But it's not like something that they just put together. It's something that generally a lot of these things are at least on a framework level already established. So if the president, at a drop of hat, has to go and say, we're going to strike targets and we want to strike Egypt. Someone's like, okay, well, here's the Egypt file that we've already developed. Like, this is the list of targets, and we'll now just make sure that this is 100% up to date. So it wasn't like there was a bit, I guess these things are already always running at low level in the background, just to make sure that they're always on deck if the president needs it at a moment's notice.
Sure. And the way that this ended up getting pushed out, for lack of a better term, is we had a drone that got shot down. That's what happened. Donald Trump basically got a hold of his staff and said, okay, I want my options. What are my options? What's going on? Where do we go from here? And the news reports, now what I want everyone to understand is, the initial news reports were easily known already, meaning that there are news agencies at the Pentagon that can very easily just ask the question and get information specifically for what they're looking for, which is that, and I'll explain, what came out was Donald Trump actually said, okay, we're going to scramble a strike against Iran. Then he said, okay, I'm going to call Iran and say, I have everything ready for a strike. So we need to talk about this. Your choice is come to the table or things go boom. Make sense? So that's called brinksmanship. It's a pretty decent tactic. It's a pretty normal tactic. It makes sense. Now, what ended up happening instead is that the news acted like he was unhinged and didn't know what he was doing.
Of course.
And that's not true at all. So, yeah. Now, it looks like we're having some issues with YouTube. So I'm going to just end the stream on YouTube and start it over again, which is always just a fantastic time. I love it. It's my favorite. Because why wouldn't it be? So, but that's the whole, the part that bothers me about this is we're going to discuss what went on with Iran. But we also need to discuss how the media is lying to the American people for a very specific purpose. And a very evil purpose, to be completely frank about it. Just a completely evil and wrong purpose. And that's what bothers me so much. So everybody on YouTube, welcome back. We were having some streaming issues. Big surprise there that somehow YouTube's giving us some streaming issues. So sorry if you guys can't get the full video, but you guys can always go and check out our podcast. Just look up Wrong Think Radio in any podcatching device, and you guys can get the conversation up until now, because for one reason or another, YouTube just wanted to be mean. And there's no surprise here. You shouldn't be surprised. I'm certainly not. but Alan, you've got a good take on what you would consider to be, well, okay, let's be fair here. I'm not going to be one of those people that's going to come out and say, just unjust war. We should just not, like, I understand the concept of unjust war, but when you start using terms, hyperbolic terms like unjust wars, there's no such thing as a just war. People are always going to disagree with the justification of a war in this day and age, because there's a million ways that people could claim that every single war is unjust. Typically, the people who lose that war claim it as being unjust. Say again?
Those people are dumb.
Sure. No, they absolutely are. And I'm not going to 100% on any side here. I'm not a fan of engaging in a war that we cannot successfully prosecute viciously, effectively, and to the end of its measure. I think that that's stupid. I think if we're going to go in there, we need to go in there with the sole purpose of winning. And then mapping out what winning looks like, which is this country's doing bad things. And so to stop them from doing bad things, they don't get to be a sovereign nation anymore until they can behave.
Sure.
That's my opinion of it. Other than that, you're not waging war. You're having a passive aggressive slap fight and people are dying over it.
Yeah.
So
I think a lot of it depends. There's absolutely a way. All of this is just the use of force. And there's the famous quote that politics or war is just politics by other means. All of this, even down to politics, is simply about using force against your opponent. There can be things like you have a big military, you can threaten force. That's political maneuvering. You could say, we're going to strike all of your anti-air defenses and make it so your country would be wide open to invasion. That then might be enough to get them back to the bargaining table to achieve a political solution. Things like we're going to, and then you just can ramp it up further. And if that's really all war is just ramping up force, the amount of force you're using against an opponent until they come to the bargaining table and accede to your demands. Things like total war would only be reserved for situations where that enemy needs to be completely, that enemy will refuse to come to the bargaining table on the right terms until they have been utterly decimated. And that's actually is a relatively more recent concept and is sort of the aberration in historical military conflicts. Because usually it's been things like France invades Germany and is just going to keep doing that until Germany says, oh man, we can't stop this offensive anymore. We're going to sue for peace. And then they sue for peace with France. France is like, hooray, we don't have to have a bunch, any more of our men die in Germany. Germany says, hooray, we don't have to have any more of our men die on the front with France. France then says, well, we essentially were winning the conflict at that point. We now get to say, we now have a stronger hand in the negotiations. And if the negotiations can't be prosecuted, France can always just say, well, we're just going to continue to keep invading Germany and killing your men. And Germany said, well, that's fine by us because maybe we'll have a counteroffensive that is able to give us the upper hand in negotiation. That's how this stuff works. So saying a just war, it's really how much force are you willing to leverage to force someone to the bargaining table to get them to do what you want? And I think this idea that we're going to just invade and annihilate countries is an aberration in the history of warfare, because usually that's not how it works. It's almost like, at the very most, it would be, we're going to wipe out your ability to wage war. Then you will say, man, we can't wage war anymore. We're going to sue for peace. And that might even end with a country has to accept the rule of a foreign power. Like our government will essentially be a puppet of this one, or these trade agreements will essentially tie us into the British Empire, for example, as the British Empire did with a lot of places. They would be like, well, we can't fight off the British, and so we will bargain and say, well, our king and government stays in power, but essentially we'll be a puppet of Britain.
Right.
So that said, a lot of people pushing towards war with Iran are not looking at it in that light. They're looking at it in the total war regime change light, which is weird, because that's not generally how these things are supposed to work. It shows a view on armed conflict that is at odds with the history of military warfare. And that view is more recent, and generally it's not in keeping with the tradition, and the tradition was there for a reason, because those types of conflicts where you just push someone to the brink that they sue for peace, that ends with a lasting peace. The idea that you're going to do like we did with Saddam Hussein in Iraq, invade, regime change, wipe out the government, that generally ends with a lot less stability post-conflict, which is why it's not the tradition in military war, in military history.
Right. Well, and to me, it seems like this is supposed to be the softer, cuddlier side of warfare. It's a very progressive concept. That.
And which concept are you talking about?
The regime change, nation building, all of that just seems like the very progressive. It's I don't know a better way to say it. It's beta male.
Well, it's based on this idea of almost like virtue signaling with the military. We're going to liberate them. We're going to free them. We're going to end this oppressive regime, etc. That is an abnormality in the history of warfare, because usually it's a lot more about, we are going to secure this for our country. We're going to secure these border provinces so our country can be better defended. We're going to secure these port cities so that our country can have a monopoly on trade. We're going to secure these regions so that our people, Nazi Lebensraum idea, like we're going to secure living space for our people. That is very different than the Nazi saying, we are going to liberate the oppressed people of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And like I said, the historical view on warfare is what you can get for your people and your nation. This more, I want to say modern neocon invention. It's not necessarily that. That would be a little bit dishonest, but that's a good way to think about it. This more modern idea of, we're going to go in and liberate them and give them a new government, and they're going to be so excited and happy and thrilled. That is not really how wars have traditionally been conducted, because it's about what you're going to give them warfare. You're going to give the people a war, and then they're going to be excited about it afterwards. That doesn't really make a lot of sense. That only could make sense in, I don't know. I think that that's just such a weird aberration. Like, think about it. Nazi invasion of the Soviet Union. We can all say the Soviets were so awful to their people. Oh, Stalin was the worst. Oh, the purges in the 20s, the great Ukrainian famine. You would think that the Soviet citizenry would be thrilled at the idea of being liberated. That did not happen. And that just goes to show just how tenuous this concept that we're going to invade, liberate, and then get this amazing response by the local people that will then just form a government that loves us and we can leave. Again, that's why these things are not traditionally how warfare is fought. Everybody hates, people hate being invaded more than they hate whatever their government is doing. I bet that we would see the same in North Korea. People hate the idea of foreigners taking over your land more than they can possibly hate their own governments, because their own governments are of, it's their people. It's what they grew up. It's what they know.
Yeah.
And that's why you just generally have not done warfare for someone else. You do it for yourself. If our whole point, if the way this was being talked about with Iran was, we are going to invade Iran to take that land for the United States, that would signal to me that people are a lot more serious and probably a lot more effective in their prosecution of the conflict. Such as, so for example, one thing that is kind of important but easily missed in this is exactly what happened with shooting down this drone. This drone was an RQ-4 Global Hawk drone, which is not an armed drone generally. They're a high-altitude, essentially long-range reconnaissance drone. We fly these things all over the place because they're very effective. They're basically like a spy plane that you can fly just everywhere all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was shot down. And it was shot down by essentially a medium to long-range surface-to-air missile fired from Iran. Iran claimed it was in Iranian airspace. We claimed it was simply flying over the Persian Gulf. Now, if this is a pretext for war. This has happened to other places, and it is a pretext. Say a British ship is fired upon by a fort in India. Well, the British might use that as cause for war, that we need to secure the coastlines to protect British shipping. And if people in the United States government were saying, we have to essentially secure the coastline of Iran to eliminate all Iranian military assets within range of striking distance of U.S. ships and aircraft in the Gulf, that would be in keeping with the normal traditions of warfare and would make sense. But that's not what's really being discussed. What's being discussed is this government has to be essentially co-opted and destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's a weird concept. It might sound normal to us, but that's not normal. It's not normal to view it as one incident, entire government has to go. That is an aberration in the history of warfare. Unless, of course, you are using it as an excuse to do something else.
Right.
And I think that's what's happening here, is Iran shoots down a drone, and some people say it's a false flag, etc. Let's just say the Iranian government fired a surface-to-air missile, shot down an American reconnaissance drone, American aircraft. The only strike that would enable or justify would be, we're going to strike every Iranian asset within range of the Persian Gulf to protect our interests. What this is essentially being used for is a bunch of people want to invade Iran and want to topple the government there and are using this as an excuse to essentially push for an overzealous response?
Yeah.
A disproportionate response, perhaps?
Yes. Now,
and I think that's where it comes into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because that means something dishonest is going on, and that makes me nervous.
Well, I feel like this is all coming from the Bill Kristol foreign policy school of attack and invade everybody, because Bill Kristol, just so you guys know, yes, I'm railing against him as now being the editor of The Bulwark, noted never Trumper, but he was also an advisor to the Bush White House and an advisor to both McCain. An advisor to McCain in 2008, and then also an advisor on the 2012 campaign. So, but understand that he runs a think tank that basically responds with "go to war." That's where the conservative trope of war hawking really came from. Was the post 9/11 Bill Kristol type thought process where country said something or did something that we kind of don't like, let's go to war. Legitimately, for about 15 years now, Bill Kristol and several other prominent conservatives have been pushing to go to war with Iran. It's silly to think that that magically went away. And that's one of the other things is people need to understand that politics happens in decades. Media cycles happen in minutes. Politics happens in decades. And people pretend like, oh, no, we have a new president. Everything's different. No, people don't abandon a decade's worth of work just because somebody else is in the White House. An interesting example of that is some of the rhetoric balance that we're seeing is it's a little weird. What I mean by that is the Democrats seemed excited over the idea of striking Iran. There are, if you do a search, you can see what looks like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi celebrating after the closed door meeting with Donald Trump over the concept that he was thinking about conducting a military strike against Iran. Now, this is notable for a couple of reasons. One, could it mean that the Democrats were pro striking Iran? Maybe. Could it also mean that they were pro the idea of Donald Trump striking Iran so they could use it as political fodder to show him as a war hawk? He's going to get us in another endless war. The reason why I bring that up is the Democrat Party should resoundingly be screaming about no armed conflict with Iran under any circumstances, because the last administration, just 2.5 years ago, was pushing hard for normalizing relations with Iran to include giving them billions of dollars and the ability to develop nuclear capabilities.
I think a lot of this goes back to this idea of an American empire. And that really came about during the Cold War, or at least I think that's when it really came into its own, is the idea of the only way to, and I don't think it was necessarily wrong at the time. I think it was actually the appropriate response in regard to the Soviet Union, was in order to defend against the Soviet Union, which is probably going to escalate into a World War III scenario, the United States essentially needs to develop a worldwide empire of, let's call it, say, allied countries or aligned countries to oppose Soviet expansion in a World War III scenario, which makes absolute sense. That absolutely makes sense when you were looking at the Soviet Union seeking to essentially exporting communism through a lot of various measures. And then, of course, if you were watching Asia fall to communism, if you watched Eastern Europe fall to communism, if you watched how much they were pushing into the Middle East, it would absolutely make sense to view the world in terms of it is the American empire versus the Soviet empire. Okay, now translate that. Again, like you said, politics happens in decades. All these people in politics were alive during that time and probably couldn't help but get infected with that same mindset, which is not easy to discard. The United States had a huge ally in the Shah of Iran. Iran was very solidly on the American empire alignment. And that was a very, very good thing for the United States, because Iran touched the Soviet Union. It was right up there. And that meant that when the Shah of Iran was in power, the United States was funneling him tons of arms and weapons, because it was viewed, this is going to be this is a major buffer state against a World War III scenario against the Soviet Union. This is what is going to protect essentially the huge oil fields of the Middle East. This is what is going to keep them under Western control in a World War III scenario, which could mean the difference between victory and defeat. And so the Shah of Iran was a huge player. It was America. They were solidly in America's pocket. I mean, to the point where the CIA had like major listening posts in northern Iran, basically spying on Soviet that could spy on Soviet nuclear weapons and satellite launches. I mean, it was really valuable. Then in the 80s, the Shah of Iran falls and is replaced by the Ayatollahs and in the Iranian Revolution. Why I preface that is because you need to understand how much of a blow to U.S. essentially World War III American empire view on foreign policy that was. America lost what was almost linchpin of a Middle Eastern defense strategy in a World War III scenario against the Soviet Union. That's why that was so such a heavy effect on the psyche of the American government. All of these people that are in government remember this. Mm-hmm. They were there before the revolution. They were there after the revolution. Everybody was very upset because things like CIA listening posts that were instrumental in watching Soviet missile tests, Soviet space tests, those were located in northern Iran. And interestingly, after it fell, got relocated to China in a very bizarre kind of shady series of events afterwards. That's neither here nor there. But like I said, it's a linchpin of the strategy. It gets lost. Everybody in the United States government has an attachment to Iran being aligned with America.
Right.
So now it's – so, I mean, afterwards, even in the 90s, they talked about Iran being the bad guy. Iran's the bad guy. Iran was part of the Axis of Evil in 2001. Now, part of this is absolutely the Iranian government has been a – let's say destabilizing force. Hezbollah, the terrorist group, is funded and trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. They export terror worldwide. There was a ton of terrorist attacks and assassinations in Europe that were linked with Iran. A bunch of the bad stuff that happened in Lebanon in the like 80s was linked with Iran. Well, because that's how Iran has handled foreign policy. They don't have a big empire like America. They don't have the ability to project power in the same way America does. They can't send a carrier strike group to somewhere, but they can send a bunch of dudes armed with grenades and handguns. You know, that's how Iran has conducted foreign policy. We can fault them for that, but you have to at least say that that's an understandable way for a smaller country to do that sort of thing. Well, this gets us to the more modern day where it's like all these people have a good reason to say Iran's the bad guy. And they also have a really, really good motivation to bring Iran back into the pocket of America. So both of those things are happening at the same time, and it's really hard to determine which is which. Are we going after Iran because they're bad guys? Because they're an enemy of our allies? Because they have done these bad things? Is that more the reason why we're irritated with Iran? Or is it because a lot of these people in government remember when Iran was a staunchly on America's side and how useful that was to politics in the region? Because you could say, well, there's big bad Iran armed with tons of U.S. weapons, and they're in the region as a launch point for any American foreign policy initiative there. The Shah was way more reliable than the Saudis. And I think it's understandable, if misguided, they might be misguided, but it's understandable to look at all these politicians and say, I understand why they want the United States to regime change Iran back to be aligned with America. I think they saw the same thing with Iraq. I think they saw we can regime change Iraq and we can get a new Iran in the region that can be a strong, powerful ally that we can use essentially as a linchpin of American power in the Middle East, because it's an important region. It's an important region, and they all remember it being an important region. All of these people got their start during the Cold War, and that's how they look at the world still, because you couldn't help but not do that. So I guess that lays the groundwork for why people like Bill Kristol are so excited about war in Iran, why all these neocons, even people on the left, these Democrats, are seemingly so drawn to war with Iran and regime change in the Middle East.
Right. And you know, it's notable because in some ways, like, I think that that's a good way of mapping out why a lot of these people, like, do what they do, what their motivations could be. But I also think that we do need to focus on that some of it, too, is just complete BS, right? Like, in some manners, these people want to engage in imperialism, but pretend like they don't. And I think that's part of my issue. Is what you want, the effect of your policy is you want imperialism. And if we were going to go and wage an imperialist war, I would be more inclined, not necessarily every single war. It's just that if they came up and said, we're going to go into Iran because we're going to completely flip it. It's going to become a U.S. asset, 100% on our side because we're going to own it, I'd be like, oh, okay, this is at least an honest discussion that we could have. Now, notable is one of the things that I love about being on the right is that we can have these discussions. There are people that are absolutely like, I'm done. I'm war weary. I'm sick of it. There's no point. There's no point in us fighting a forever war. I like that those people are on our side because they're willing to discuss it for the most part on the different reasons. And they have very, very good reasoning on why they would not support any sort of conflict. On the other side of the right, you do have people that are ready to go to war with basically anybody, and some of them not for all the right and correct and honest reasons. To be completely fair, there is a contingent, not to get into the whole background of it, but there's a huge contingent of people in the conservative movement that want to go after Iran because of Israel. And that is a very stupid reason to support a war. American blood doesn't need to get shed for any other country, especially one that is not an ally. And by that, I mean, before everyone freaks out on chat and before we get a bunch of emails, by that, I mean, we literally do not have an alliance with Israel of a if strike happens, then everyone responds in kind like we do with NATO. Unless they're going to come to the table and be in a treaty like what we have in NATO, if we had a NATO alliance with Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, and maybe even Egypt like that, this would be a very different story. But American troops don't need to bleed for Israel's proxy war against Iran.
That's true. And again, that's another aspect of this conflict that has to be considered, especially in the greater historical context of the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
Israel, after the loss of Iran, Israel was now the major American player in the region. And again, we have to think of this like it's the American Empire versus the Soviet Union prepping for a World War III scenario. Israel's there. Israel's an ally of the United States. Well, aligned with the United States, given your point. Israel is now the prime point for an American push against the Soviet Union if they try to expand south and take the oil fields of the Middle East in a World War III scenario. So it is understandable that the United States invests a ton of money into building up the Israeli military. And the Israelis aren't dumb. They see this and they know their position. This is actually what kind of ruined the Cold War, was when all of these like small countries realized that they could essentially play the United States against the Soviet Union and vice versa to get what they want. Syria played it up by saying, well, we need to protect. Syria played it up with the Soviet Union to get a ton of money and aid and weapons. Israel played it up with the United States to get a bunch of free money and aid and weapons. And that scenario has not really stopped.
Right.
The United States looks at Israel and says, well, if we want to push power into this region, it's going to have to go through only a couple places. Israel seems like a logical choice. So all these people have this sort of in their minds, Israel's a linchpin of American foreign policy. We have to protect Israel. We have to protect Israel and make sure they stay unmolested because they are our foothold in the region.
So
and
now
if Israel wants to go to war with Iran, it's like, well, icing on the cake. That's great. Like Israel doesn't like Iran. Israel wants a weaker Iran. That's going to help Israel. But that de facto helps the United States fighting the Soviet Union, World War III. Except the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. We're not in the World War III scenario anymore. But all these people grew up and got their entire first couple decades in politics with that being the mindset. So there is something where they're like, okay, like what's good for Israel is good for the United States. And that might have used to have been true. At least it'd be arguable or at least understandable why someone could have that point of view in say 1960.
Right.
But it's not 1960, almost 2020. That calculus has seriously been degraded, especially as there've been so many more developments with Saudi Arabia, with Iraq. Those are a lot friendlier now, and we don't have to deal with the Soviet Union. And I think a lot of these people are still stuck in this mindset of we have to support Israel. We have to support Israel's on the brink of destruction, Six-Day War. They're almost going to get destroyed by these Arab armies. Yeah, that's not the case anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't have to stick up for Israel. Israel's not under threat the way it was in, say, 1970. Israel is like the major military power in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And they essentially have an alliance with the second major military power in the region, which is Saudi Arabia. they can fight their own wars. They can fight Iran if they wanted to. In fact, I bet if we did the numbers, Saudi-Israeli alliance would probably be pretty well matched against a Iranian-Syrian alliance in a Middle Eastern war scenario.
Now, the reason why I bring this up for two things. The reason why I bring it up is Mike Cernovich on Twitter actually put out a hilarious tweet. I didn't screen grab it, but he did a poll asking which branch of service Ben Shapiro should join to go fight his war against Iran. I haven't heard it personally, but there's just been a lot of stuff on social media about how upset Ben Shapiro is that we didn't do anything against Iran and that we didn't strike. And it's the perfect not to make this about beating up on Ben Shapiro. I mean, a little bit, but it's that classic, the country club, Kurt Schlichter says the cruise ship Republicans, and how they're always ready to just send everybody but them to war. And like I said, I'm not an anti-war peacenik. I was a soldier. You were a soldier. There are times that going to war makes a lot of sense. And I'm not going to take it off the table. And anybody who says that we should is an idiot. Anyone who's like, there's never a time for you're going to die. That's your response. But the point is that I am very weary of aspects of the conservative movement that are so willing and ready to send everybody but them to war. There is something to be said that in the process of us reforming conservatism to becoming big tent, to not necessarily reforming conservatism, but reforming the Republican Party to being truly big tent, to updating itself with the times, which I'll get into in just a second, is the acknowledgement that you can't just sit there at a country club or sit there at a think tank and tell leaders that they need to send 20,000 American men and women overseas and not think about that as a human cost. And I don't think that a lot of these lobbyists, I don't think that a lot of these think tank people actually think about it. I think they look at it literally like a chess game. I think they look at it like a chess game and they don't evaluate the human cost. And one thing that the Republican Party, like these think tanks are going to be whatever they're going to be. They have their own interests. They have whatever, and that's fine. But the GOP needs to understand that American soldiers and American veterans are part of their base. And they need to look at that base the same as they would any other aspect of their base, i.e. decisions to go fight in combat. You need to look at like any policy position that you would do domestically. They wouldn't do something that they thought would be politically hurtful to a minority community if they thought that people could turn around and blast it up against them. But meaning they're not going to put a policy forward that would give their opposition the ability to pepper them consistently. If it were a minority community, they just need to have the same evaluation when it comes to soldiers. That doesn't mean not sending them to war ever, because the liberals are going to whine about it, but it means that you need to consider them as people and not chess pieces on a board.
Sure.
Because I know that was a little circuitous, but the point that I'm making is the GOP doesn't seem to understand that the veteran community and the military community is behind them almost 100%. And they also need to understand that they can lose those people very easily if they continue not realizing that they're people.
Right. And I think one of the things I think you're highlighting is one of the big unlearned lessons about Iraq. So you had, again, politics happens in decades. You had 1990 initial Gulf War. Massively successful air campaign, obliterated the Iraqi military. U.S. ground forces got in. Essentially, the combat ground forces got in was always unbelievably one-sided in our favor. and the Air Force just mopped everything up. So if you looked at that, you'd say, holy, oh my gosh, we can wage war with almost no casualties in an incredibly precise and effective manner.
Right.
Then look at things like Afghanistan. We put a few special operators on the ground. They coordinated airstrikes. Boom, Taliban falls in like a weekend. Coming off of that, it's a lot of these people got this idea that we could essentially wait, that we had gotten past the age of a messy war, mm-hmm. that we could wage war in a precise air power directed way. And it would just be, you know, diving a scalpel into your opponent and boom, win, success. And then came Iraq in 2003. Everybody going into Iraq in 2003 was looking at the Gulf War and looking at the success in Afghanistan, thinking we're just going to have a massive air campaign. We're going to out in troops, and then our troops are just going to waltz right in. The entire corrupt structure of Iraq is going to fall. The head's going to be cut off the snake, and success. And that happened initially, but then it immediately stopped happening.
Mm-hmm.
So Iraq falls. I mean, we invade with a bunch of troops. Not enough troops by a long shot. I think the military wanted, if I have to remember, it was like something like a couple hundred thousand troops, because they said, well, we want to secure all these WMD sites that you told us are important and secure these population centers. And then Rumsfeld and friends essentially said, no, no, the air campaign is going to be so effective. Iraq's going to collapse. We know more than you, dumb, you know, aged cold warrior stuck in your old war mindset. The new younger generation, Rumsfeld and friends, younger, we're all modern thinkers. We know how effective air power is going to be. We saw what happened in the Gulf and Afghanistan. You're going to go in, wipe everybody aside, and boom, Iraq's going to be great. That sort of happened. We did kind of mop the floor with Iraqi troops. It wasn't as clean as it probably should have been. If you look into the initial invasion of Iraq 2003, it was a lot messier than a lot of people predicted. But let aside, Iraq falls. Boom, we took over. The lesson people didn't learn in Iraq was that the war didn't end when we said mission accomplished. And they now look at everything through that lens. We're going to go to war with Iran, and they look at it as Iraq up to mission accomplished. And they think, well, it's going to go so well. We're going to have almost no casualties. We'll obliterate things with air power. Success. I think a lot of people mistakenly look at Iraq as two different wars, when in reality, they're simply the different stages of the exact same conflict. And that's the problem. It's same with Afghanistan. Blowing away the Taliban with the special operators in the Northern Alliance was not a different conflict than the one that troops are still fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the minds of a lot of people, especially top military personnel and especially congressional leadership, that those represent to them different conflicts. This is, I think, a big source of misunderstanding, and it probably can even be intentional misunderstanding. It looks really attractive to just, oh, we'll flatten all their air defenses, then we'll blow up all their tanks from the sky, and U.S. troops will just sort of drive on in, like they did in the Gulf, like they kind of did in Afghanistan, like they sort of did in Iraq. Because you don't want to look at the longer-term possibilities that make all of that way more complicated. It means it's like, no, we're actually going to have to fight a serious war to take this country. Yeah, we might obliterate the conventional military, but there is going to then be, as the lesson we should have learned was, after that there's going to be a decades-long period of fighting insurgencies, rebuilding the country, reestablishing things, and that nation-building component is part of the whole conflict.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what anyone proposes about Iran. If you listen to the way they talk and the way they can discuss it, they're not proposing, we'll airstrike them, we'll invade, and then we're going to spend the next decade in the country rebuilding it and making it new. No, they just say, oh, we're going to airstrike them. Troops are going to walk in. We'll swat them aside because the American military is so impressive. And then what? Question mark, question mark, question mark, success?
Pretty much.
Well, I think it just goes to this idea that a lot of people have very wrong ideas about the way the U.S. military engages in war. But it's not so much the U.S. military. It's just wrong ideas about war in general. Because we have all of these impressive weapons, which makes strikes very easy and effective. But that it's almost like in your mind, they confuse military strikes, which are sort of a almost tactical level. You're solving a tactical problem.
Right.
With actual war, which is a strategic problem. And it's an understandable kind of disconnect. Oh, we can blow up all their air defenses. That means we win the war. It's like, no. But it's easy to see how you could mistake that.
Right. Now, final point on this. Something I'm going to ask you. What it sounds like to me when we break all of this down, when we go through how it works, we talk about the Cold War mindset, we talk about all of those different things. What it sounds like to me is very much almost the same as what we see with the economy. Now, bear with me on this.
Okay.
One of the things that's great about the populist push, for lack of a better term, I'd really rather just say the nationalist push, the nationalism that is now kind of growing out of the right in the United States, not the mean nationalism that the left is talking about, the good kind where we actually care about our country, we want to develop a culture, we want to have sovereignty, those things, is sure. We've realized that, I'm not trying to be insulting, but that the baby boomers got stuck with the mindset of, but we've always done it this way. And even when it doesn't work, they still slam their head up against the wall saying, but we've always done it this way. That was actually very easily provable in the first 2 years of the Trump administration. If there's one thing that I think historically is going to be recognized, I'm not going to go down this rabbit hole too much. I'll get to how it affects conflict. If there's one thing that I think that history is going to show in the Trump administration, something that's going to be the most prolific, is that the Trump administration upended the apple cart when it came to the classic baby boomer idea of how the economy works. Trump came in there and went, I'm going to do these things. And all these economists go, we've never done it like that. It won't work. And it was all this baby boomer generation of it has to be bottom up, you know, strict control, Federal Reserve interest rates. And Trump went, that's really dumb. Let's just do this. And everyone was terrified and it worked amazing. I feel like when it comes to conflict, the baby boomer generation is used to war being World War II. We go in, it's victorious, it's a huge assault, and it's amazing. To, like you said, the Gulf War of, we're so technologically advanced, we just punch them in the face and they back off. But all of these policymakers live in this past that doesn't exist now. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So sure. I much like what we saw with the economy, it's all these people that live in a past and literally cannot conceive the reality of today. They're so arrogant and elitist of no. I've been a senator for 30 years, and I've been successful as a senator because of this. And they refuse to consider that there's a better path, a better way. I think that, like I said, I don't want to go down too many rabbit holes, but I think John McCain was one of the worst people when it came to this because he was so prolific in the Senate on the Republican Party that he would just sit there and say, I've been doing this for this long, and I was in World War II, or I was in Vietnam. I did blah, 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 blah. Everyone went, oh, this guy must know what he's talking about. And even when he was wrong, they said, well, that's as good as we could have had, and no one could have presented a better idea. And so I think that we have all of these Cold War era dinosaurs trying to push policy that literally doesn't work. It didn't work in Iraq. It didn't work in Afghanistan. Hell, it didn't work in Vietnam. But they bang their head up against the wall and say, but we've always done it this way. Because we can look back at almost all of the conflicts we've had post-World War II and explain exactly where we failed. Yet our lawmakers do the same exact thing every time.
Yeah, every time.
Primarily letting the media have a say in the war.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it is they're so, because we have such a divided politics, it means that everything about your warfare, this is what they talk about when they say it's a fourth generation warfare,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to third generation. which was kind of the more World War II, maybe Korea, possibly saving Vietnam. But they say we're now in fourth generation warfare, where politics and the media are an aspect of the war. And just look at the United States today. We couldn't have a response to something like World War II in the same way because we're such a divided country. Mm-hmm. And we might all think, oh, we'll all come together and unify. I disagree. I think that in, say, a World War II type scenario, you would have Democrats and you would have Republicans essentially fighting each other at the same time the war is going on over who gets to control the direction of that conflict. And like you said with the media is absolutely going to get involved to essentially manipulate the events of that conflict to get the outcome they desire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why that all these things, I think that's why it might be so hard for the United States government to do what is necessary in these conflicts rather than fail. Like if we looked at Afghanistan, why was there ever an Afghan government? That's ridiculous. It didn't really exist before, and it shouldn't have after we invaded. We should have said, we own Afghanistan. This general is now the imperial military governor of Afghanistan. The United States is completely in control of this country, and we are going to slowly develop it into a cohesive country afterwards. Saying, oh, there's an Afghan government that we have to ask permission to go take out Taliban targets, that's ridiculous. But the only reason that exists and the only reason that happened was because the political infighting within the United States government wouldn't have allowed us to do what was necessary because we were essentially fighting ourselves at the same time. We were I would say almost like the American soldier was as much fighting the U.S. government as he was fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Yes.
It was fighting the U.S. government for the ability to prosecute the war the way that would be effective, while the bunch of people in the U.S. government were fighting the military to try and make it less effective.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that wasn't their stated aim, because that's almost too crazy to believe. But I think they were saying this is wrong. We need to be loving to these people. We need to be nice. It looks so bad. Really, I think a lot of the government was saying during these conflicts was, it is going to help me get reelected if I am able to pander to a bunch of voters saying, I support the good things and not the bad things. I want the United States government and the military to be nice to these people, and you should vote for me because I want nice things and not bad things. A bunch of gullible American voters thought, that's great. I too want nice things and I want to stand against bad things. And most importantly, I want to tell other people how much I support the good things and how I'm against the bad things I am, because then I can say that I'm superior to them. And then they voted for these politicians, and those politicians forced the U.S. military to do good things, not bad things. And therefore, we were in these quagmires for years because we couldn't do the necessary bad things. We had to do the ineffective good things.
Well, I think
but that's what again, we're fighting ourselves so much, we can't be effective on the national stage, on the international stage.
Right. And I think it's pretty easy to say that. I understand wanting to be fair, or trying to be at least fair, or at least even keeled about it. But let's just be honest. Barack Obama didn't want to fight in Afghanistan. He had promised all of his dumb liberal supporters that he was going to pull out of Afghanistan. And the minute that he had got the minute that he finally actually showed up to any briefings, because he never did as a senator, that much is obvious by the stupidity of his concepts of foreign policy. The minute he got briefed and somebody was like, yeah, this would be awful if you did this, he realized he couldn't keep a campaign promise. Which is pretty normal for a Democrat anyway, because they never keep their campaign promises. But what he certainly didn't want was CNN having to do a news report about anything happening in Afghanistan. So instead, he just sent us there to basically try our best not to actually get into any sort of fights. Yeah. But if we did, you were going to die because you couldn't fight effectively. And God forbid, if you survived and won, you might be facing charges of court-martial because you shot a Taliban insurgent. Much like these Navy SEALs that are like getting their that are being called war criminals, by the way, by even never Trump conservatives, are being called war criminals for shooting bad people. Just
right.
So you
and
know,
a better way to,
there were not war crimes in Afghanistan.
I think a better way to describe it was Obama and politicians like him realized that they could push policy, they could push military policy as a way to get votes. I'm going to push a policy that's going to get us out of, I'm going to push policy to get us out of Afghanistan. Okay, but should we, and is it time, and what's that policy? Is it going to be effective? That was never really discussed. It was, I am going to use promises and explain, I'm going to use these explanations of new military policies I'm going to push on the military as a way to get people not in the military to vote for me. Because
right.
It wasn't ever, it stopped being about success in those military endeavors and started being about, how can I use this military endeavor that we're involved in to get myself votes from people? And like I said, look at what Obama campaign, we're going to get out of these countries. And did people say, should we? Is it time to do that? Like, is this going to be good for our soldiers? Is it good for our mission there? No, it was never about that. It was simply about, I'm going to say and push on the military what's going to get me votes at home.
Well, right. And the whole idea there is just that they didn't want to fight it effectively. And he was a pussy about it. Like, I don't know a better way to say it. Eric's asking, like, why sign up? Like, why sign up? Why sign up? Why would anyone sign up for this? Why would anyone sign up for the military? Why would they do it?
It's pretty awesome.
Because I love my country. I don't care. Politicians are idiots, no matter who they are, no matter whose side they're on. Politicians are idiots. And what goes on in Washington, D.C. does not make up the entire military. Yes, we had a lot of issues when it came to Barack Obama being the president of the United States while Alan and I were fighting in Afghanistan. We can talk about certain military officers who wanted to capitulate to the canned narrative of hearts and minds and that garbage because they were taught that they had to basically suck up to Barack Obama, because if you didn't, you would lose your leadership position. If you were a military general and you didn't kiss Barack Obama's ass, you got fired. So I don't want to go down this line because we have other stuff we have to talk about. But understand that just because Obama sucked at running a military and was a coward when it came to prosecuting war and got a Nobel Peace Prize, even though he destabilized way more countries during his tenure in office, that does not mean that serving in the military isn't a great venture. I served because I love my country, because I want to defend the Constitution, and because I wanted to be able to fight for the things I care about.
Yeah.
That doesn't equate to me putting on the uniform, doesn't equate to me loving who's in the office. It doesn't equate to me supporting every decision they make. I fight. Every soldier takes an oath to the Constitution and the nation. We just have to obey the orders of the president, because the majority of the American people voted for that person. But what that doesn't equate to is I'm a soldier and always will be, because I care about this country. I want to fight for this country. Sometimes that does mean getting deployed in the most dumb possible fashion to the most idiotic and almost unwinnable situations. But I will tell you something. Regardless of all of the dumb policy decisions that occurred in Washington, D.C., if there's one thing that soldiers are really good at, is finding a way to win with our hands tied. We did that, and we did it exceedingly well, and it pissed off those bureaucrats every single day.
Mm-hmm.
Trust me.
And the military is very cool.
Oh, no, it's fantastic.
A lot of it is you get to do stuff that you cannot do as a civilian. I mean, riding helicopters is awesome. Riding around in armored vehicles is cool. Shooting guns is great. Like, using a lot of the equipment we got to use. I think it's totally worth it for a lot of people, and it's great. And if it is used effectively, it'd be even better. But I think there's a lot number of skills and experiences that you get in the military that you cannot really replicate elsewhere that absolutely make it worth it. Or at least it was worth it. I don't know anymore. Some of the stories I hear coming out about how the military has been progressing. If you're going to go in, maybe go special forces.
Yeah.
Try to be a ranger at least.
I agree. All right. So good cap on that. We've beaten this horse to death. We get it. Iran. The big point that I wanted to make, I mean, this is good because I think this is the only show that actually went through the process of the pros and cons on it and didn't just shill their point immediately. I will admit, I'm very proud that Donald Trump made the decisions that he made. I think he did a very good decision in the idea of putting everything on the table in front of Iran and making them have to respond back. This is good diplomacy, to be completely honest. And I think that that's what pisses the media off. The media is infuriated that we didn't go to war with Iran because they wanted Trump to get into a war that they didn't think he could win or that they wouldn't allow him to win. They wanted Trump to send American troops to Iran to start a campaign there. And CNN, let's be honest, I'm calling it right now. CNN was excited to have dead soldiers so they could jump up and down on their graves. CNN wanted a pile of dead American servicemen that they could sit there and like sneer at and say, this is Donald Trump's doing. They wanted American soldiers' bodies piled to the rooftops so they could push a narrative to try to get him to lose 2020. They wanted Americans dead so they could try to win. That's how disgusting the left is right now. And you can see it in the rhetoric. Listen to what they are saying, because this does exist. They're pissed because they didn't want to go to war with Iran, but they wanted Donald Trump to go to war with Iran so American soldiers would die so they could use it to try to push their agenda.
Yeah.
I know that a lot of people will say that I'm being mean and that my rhetoric is out there, but I'm not wrong.
It wouldn't surprise me if we saw a bunch of video of dead Iranians. Like, oh my gosh, look at all these poor people that Donald Trump is killing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, can you guys – it would not surprise me if people on the left were – trying to push Donald Trump into a war just so they would have something to complain about.
Yep.
That would absolutely be icing on the cake for them.
100%. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the dumb takes. Speaking of 2020, the Democrat Party is having itself a very interesting time. Now, their acolytes are out and strong, especially here in the district in D.C., specifically their acolytes being Antifa. So Antifa is still out there. They still exist. They're still conducting their adorable little operations, the most recent of which is this. This is a sign that you can see all throughout Washington, D.C. right now, which is block the alt-right. And then that's a picture of Tucker Carlson, obviously. Now, On the bottom here, what you can't see that's blurred out slightly here at the bottom is Tucker Carlson's phone number and address. He lives in the Washington, D.C. area. And also, they've done this for several other right-wing talking heads like Sean Hannity and whomever, putting out their addresses, encouraging their deranged supporters into violence. They want them to go and commit violence at these people's homes. And they say that they shouldn't feel safe. The concept of this from all of these quote anti-fascists is that right-wingers should not feel safe in their homes, which means you should make them feel unsafe in their homes. They are pushing for violence. The media is supporting this. The Democrat Party is absolutely supporting this and funding it. Yeah. If you want to go check it out, we talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago, but there's a Quillette article that shows a direct connection between Antifa and a bunch of left-wing journalists. Antifa is embedded in left-wing mainstream media. They're not divorced. This is not a group that's operating, and then these journalists are reporting on it. These journalists are part of it. There are college professors, journalists. There are policy professionals in D.C. and lobbyists that are all part of Antifa. This is a larger movement than people think. Antifa is a group that is funded by large progressive groups, specifically as the foot soldiers of their movement. This is a very – these are not separate groups that just happen to interact. This is all part of a large-scale movement. Progressivism and the left does not operate in a small grassroots level. They operate in a top-down methodology. So Antifa is connected as part of a larger situation or a larger operation. You need to understand that. And the way that you know that that's happening is how all of them piggyback off of each other. Now, I'm going to explain to you what I think that what I think this is in other ways. Well, that, and I have a criticism on the right that I need to put out. I have to punch right. And I want you guys to understand why I say that. First of all, what Antifa thinks it's doing is going out there and just getting YouTube videos out there and getting people excited about standing outside of some right-winger's house like Tucker Carlson, banging drums and shaking tambourines and being annoying. And they think that that's to them, that's activism. What I think their handlers and their financiers are actually hoping for is that they push hard enough that somebody in Antifa gets killed. What they want is they want these protesters annoying someone enough that Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity or one of these others ends up actually taking a shot and killing an Antifa member. Then they're going to twist it into another Heather Heyer scenario where these people are committing violence. These people are threatening groups of people for really no apparent reason. There'd be no big deal if the black bloc masked people were there. This would go off and nobody would care about it. But the fact that all of these violent thugs show up and they start making threats and they start being violent, then something bad happens. Then they lift the black masked person who's out there with a club in their hand, smashing windows, kicking and punching people, and screaming obscenities and violence, all of a sudden becomes a bathed white robed angel. Oh, they were a beautiful person. Yeah. They volunteered at the animal shelter and they were perfect and beautiful. And if they're slightly overweight, let's find a picture from 10 years ago where they look at least moderately attractive. And they would do that. Yeah. And so I want people to understand this because I think that that is the larger concept here. They want another Heather Heyer. They want another black clad thug to get killed so they can make them into an angel and completely deflect the fact that it is a violent paramilitary communist group.
Yeah.
Is that even a hot take, Alan? I don't think it's really even a hot take. I think the facts are there.
Oh, I think a lot of it, especially like you point out, putting out the poster of Tucker Carlson, is it encouraging people to be violent against people on the right wing? Sure. I think the bigger impact is that it makes people afraid to voice their opinions. Mm-hmm. It makes people, I think it's designed to make normal people afraid of voicing their opinions because you would know, well, I would stand up against some of these things, but I might get targeted by a violent group like Antifa.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to shut up and stay isolated rather than, say, grouping together and saying, no, we're not going to stand for this. It's a very good way to poison any kind of resistance to the way the left is trying to twist the country.
Right. No, absolutely. And my punch right on this. On that poster, it's ban the alt-right.
Mm-hmm.
The people on the right, anybody who's right wing, the Ben Shapiro's and Ben Shapiro's, Andrew Clavin's, Tucker Carlson's, all of these people, Steven Crowder, Mark Levin, all of them, these hosts, these big names should never have accepted the term alt-right. They should have ignored it. They should have left it alone because these idiots, when they use the term alt-right, now I say these idiots, not every single one of those people I'm talking about does that, right? And let's be fair, a lot of it's Ben Shapiro because he loves playing victim to the alt-right. He loves to be, I'm the alt-right's number one target. The reason why I'm bringing this up is alt-right is a term that's used by liberals. It's used specifically as a very divisive term. Because what they did, this was their plan all along. They created this term, or maybe the term was created, but they grabbed a hold of the term and adopted it. The left wing claimed that they were against the alt-right because they knew that this would create a division in the conservative movement, in the right wing, because they would say, oh, no, we're okay with your opinion. It's the alt-right we don't like. The alt-right, because it started off with the alt-right is white supremacists and neo-Nazis. They're really bad. And these idiots like Ben Shapiro, who tell us don't trust the media is lying to you, they're trying to destroy the republic, went, I'm going to trust the media, and I'm going to help them defend the republic that I just said they want to destroy. And they said, I'm also against the alt-right. The alt-right's terrible. And then the left went, the alt-right is now this person, and this person, and this person, and this person, and it's now everybody. And now you see, if you watch like Ben Shapiro's Twitter feed, he's constantly exasperated because I'm not alt-right, guys. Stop calling me that. But that's the thing, Ben. Yes, you are. You are alt-right because you'd have to be an idiot to not think that that's exactly what the liberals were doing. You can't be that stupid, but instead you didn't think you wanted to play victim. So I'm the biggest target of the alt-right. All these Nazis don't like me. You knew that there was not a huge contingent of Nazis on the right wing. You know that Nazis really don't exist in America, but you wanted a virtue signal, and now you've painted yourself into a corner because now everybody's alt-right. And you have to commit and stand against it. And congratulations, you're now Judas, because you have to sit there and condemn everybody on your side. Great job. I would make a joke about 40 pieces of silver, but it would probably get our channel banned.
Don't do that.
Makes sense. Am I out of my mind on this?
No, absolutely. I think it's very good to – it makes sense.
The problem I have with this is that people that are supposed to be intelligent critics intelligent critics of the media fell into their trap, and I, for the life of me, cannot figure out how.
I kind of wonder if the falling into that trap was not entirely honest. That if there's people that fell into that trap because they wanted to.
Yeah. I mean, sure. Because they wanted to be accepted by the fans.
Yeah. I think there is a good amount of people on the right that have accepted the definitions of people on the left because they maybe wanted there to be this evil right. I think a lot of people on the right wanted there to be an eviler people on the right wing to distance themselves from. They could say, I'm not a racist. Look at me. Those people are the racists, and I'm distanced from them. If people on the right kind of are unified about together, then you can't as easily say, distance yourself from the accusations of being a racist. You know, like think that's because that gets thrown around all the time. And it's a lot easier to say, no, that's those guys over there, not confronting the point itself. Not saying you're only calling me a racist to win this argument is – that's a lot harder than saying, no, it's those guys. You should listen to my ideas about limited government.
No, it's those guys.
Like it's really useful. It's really useful to have a more extreme group to – throw all the responsibility onto rather than, fighting back against the accusation.
Right.
It's easier to pass the buck than to actually deal with the problem in front of you.
True. No. And I agree. And it's just so, well, you all know it's tiring. It is exceedingly tiring having to deal with, I want it to be ignorance, but it can't possibly be ignorance. It has to be like some form of evil or some sort of chicanery, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
Because you can't be this dumb. You can't.
No.
So
like this is one of those things where if it, like, it's so obvious to see how it's so transparent that it's kind of hard to think that anybody getting caught in this trap of, well, you're all right. It's kind of like, yeah. Are you getting caught in that trap, or are you willingly walking into it?
Yeah. Right. No, exactly. And I'm still very much of the opinion that certain people are more inclined that they would prefer over their principles and their policies winning, and the United States having a change to where that becomes the primary focus of the citizenry. I think that they're more inclined to just want to be at a cocktail party in Los Angeles with a bunch of liberals around there and get to hear somebody say, oh, don't worry, he's one of the good ones. I think that that is more important to some of the talking heads on the right than it ever is about actual policy. Now, speaking of stupidity,
way easier to do that.
Say again?
It's way easier to do that than to actually confront what your, say, people on the left are actually doing, than to go to that cocktail party, like you said, and actually confront these people and say, you're all a bunch of communists that hate America that are willing to send us down the road to hell so you can continue virtue signaling to each other. That's unfriendly. And it's a lot, and it allows you to stay friendly and just say, oh, they're just complaining about people that aren't me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they're complaining about these other people, not me though. I'm one of the good ones. Speaking of some fun and virtue signaling, the left is having a lot of problems. This is something that everybody really needs to understand and grab a hold of, because one of my good friends had a very good point a little while back, which was that you have to understand that the left might not be fighting hard. Like, you could look at progressives and the left right now and think, wow, they're really fighting hard. They're really like pushing strong going into the 2020 election. But there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not that they're strong and they're doing well, and more that they're like an animal backed into a corner. And that's why they're lashing out as violently as they are. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that the left is really actually falling apart on itself. It's imploding. And there's a lot of like internal turmoil in the Democrat Party and the American left. The reason why I bring this up is it's a good point that we have to focus on, because if the left is imploding on itself because of the push towards socialism, the push to communism, they want communism in the United States. They're pushing hard for it. And because they have created so many monsters to try to push a social narrative, that monster is now coming back at them to fight. They don't know what to do. This is good for us to know, because we need to needle at that with the everyday liberals we know and point it out to them so they can see the weakness, so they can see the cracks in the armor. And here's a really good example. This is something that Pete Buttigieg had to deal with, because he's a mayor and stuff happens in a city. And since he's the mayor of, what is it, Indianapolis?
Sure.
South Bend. Sorry. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. Well, there was a fatal shooting in South Bend, Indiana. Now, let me give you the facts of this fatal shooting in South Bend, Indiana. An officer fatally shot a black man. And I don't know if you guys know this, but as far as Black Lives Matter is concerned, every black man shot by a white officer was innocent and doing nothing. He didn't do nothing. Yeah. He got shot, right? That's, police go around shooting minorities all the time. So why would you question it? The reality is...
Was this the one where the guy shot like five people? Shot a guy five times?
I'm not actually sure. What I do know is, I mean, I can pull it up. What I do know is that this was the big issue that I got from the left, which was officer fatally shot this man. Officer said that he had a knife and was coming at him. And the big complaint from all of the Black Lives Matter types were his body cam wasn't on. Which, okay, I understand that, except for I understand that except for the fact that the body cameras are there for a good reason. Sometimes they should be pushed. Sometimes it's not going to happen. Just because a police officer doesn't have their body camera on doesn't immediately make somebody innocent. Like I said, I don't have a ton of background on this story because, to be completely fair, I don't care.
Name me one time Black Lives Matter has ever supported the actions of an officer and said they were justified.
Yeah, absolutely never.
Body camera on, it doesn't matter. Regardless, they will find a way to make this the officer's fault or something. I don't think there ever will be a situation where an officer has to use deadly force that Black Lives Matter would find it meeting their standards.
Right. If it was a minority.
It's a lot about the focus of their entire group.
Right. And I pulled up a news article here so we can make sure that everybody's got all of the information. This is from the 21st. It's from NPR, right? So it's probably garbage. In South Bend, Indiana, a white police officer shot and killed a black resident over the weekend. Mayor Pete Buttigieg came off the presidential campaign trail to deal with the fallout. I want to get the actual – there's a whole bunch of a transcript here, which I kind of don't care about. So I'm actually going to find a different story that isn't that. Sorry. Oh, yeah, Huffington Post, even better. Let's get their garbage take. A lawyer for the family of a black man fatally shot by a white police officer in the Indiana city where Pete Buttigieg is mayor on Friday accused the Democrat presidential candidate of failing to be aggressive enough to setting rules to curb police misconduct. Logan's death, that was the gentleman's name, prompted Pete Buttigieg to cancel much of his out-of-state campaigning to pay attention. And drew attention to his struggles appealing to black voters. Because that's what matters.
Yeah.
Authorities have said that Sergeant Ryan O'Neill was looking for a man reportedly breaking into cars at about 3:30 a.m. Sunday when he fired one shot that hit Logan and another that missed after Logan threatened him with a knife. Logan's family and others in the African-American community have reacted with anger over no video existing of the confrontation because O'Neill's dash and body cameras weren't activated. So that's the background. Now, I want everyone to understand something real quick here. Black Lives Matter does this all the time. We have every reason to believe that this officer reacted appropriately, that a man was coming at him with a knife and he fired a fatal shot.
Right.
We have every reason to believe that. But Black Lives Matter is going to make this about everything but the actual incident. Understand this.
True.
If this police officer acted inappropriately, of course the police would be investigating. If there was any question, if he didn't have a knife, there's no explanation that there's no knife at the scene, is there? No. They're not saying anything about that. What they're not saying in these news reports, what they're not doing, is saying anything the officer said was untrue. What they're saying is, we don't have video. They're not saying that there's anything that conflicts the officer's account. They're just saying that they don't have video of it.
Yeah.
Why? Because now they can sit there and they can create. They can muddy the water. Well, we don't have the video. They're not saying that there wasn't a knife. They're not saying that this wasn't a violent criminal. They're not saying that he wasn't breaking into cars at 3:30 in the morning. Are they? They're not saying any of that. What they're saying, though, is you can't prove that he was being threatening. So now we can muddy the water and we can suggest that this cop might be racist. And maybe that's why he shot a black man. That's what they're doing. Understand this, because it's all based on lies. There's no truth here. And now, people are innocent until proven guilty. Police can Police can do wrong things. Police can be bad. It is possible they are humans like everyone else. But Black Lives Matter isn't trying to ferret out bad police. Black Lives Matter is trying to ferret out white police. And in reality, all police.
Yeah.
But watch this exchange that Pete Buttigieg had to deal with. And this is where the left is going to fall apart going into 2020.
Must be treated fairly.
Sorry, let me start the clip from the top.
We demand that I would like you to hear for me.
Okay.
One, we demand that Officer O'Neill and Officer Knepper be fired immediately.
I want you to understand something. Alan, I'm not sure if you're actually even able to hear this.
I can hear it.
Oh, okay, good, good, good. The first thing that I want to point out is no presidential candidate should be giving any daylight to masked thugs. These people in this video down here do not deserve the attention of anyone. If you can't show your face, you don't need to be part of the national dialogue. We should not be giving power to people who cover their faces like this and then demand things of the mayor. Your demands shouldn't be met at all. We live in a country where you are able to voice your opinion with a group. You could go to a city council meeting and stand up and say, I am so-and-so. I am a representative of the community. Here is what I have talked to over 2,000 people in this community, and here is what they feel. This is how the African-American community feels right now. You can do that. Instead, what are they doing? They're Black bloc dressed like communist revolutionaries, sitting there with a bullhorn and yelling, we have demands for you. You're going to fire these officers immediately. These people do not deserve the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. Why in God's name are we even giving them any attention? And watch this idiot make a complete ass out of himself, which of course he's going to, because he just realized, guess what? You're giving power to a bunch of communist revolutionaries. You're going to the guillotine. No matter what, you're going to the guillotine, and no amount of you being gay is going to save the fact that you're a white man. Sorry, but you're also banging a white man. You're just the worst of the worst. Congratulations, Pete. Welcome to the hell you created. But let's go on.
Let me start by talking about what we all believe. We all believe that everybody must be treated fairly, that racism has zero place in our police department or any police department.
A thing I want to note here. There's no charge of racism. But Black Lives Matter thinks that everything that happens is due to racism. Every violent thug that gets shot by police, that's black. Only the black ones.
Yeah.
Every black violent thug shot by police.
Anytime a black person is shot by police, anytime they're arrested, anytime anything bad happens to a black person, it's always because of racism.
Right, because black people don't commit crimes.
Yeah, in their world, black people are incapable of committing crimes. They're, I assume, a lot like dogs, because dogs can't commit crimes. They're just dogs. And if someone, you know, says a dog committed a crime, well, then they're probably, you know, a bad person.
I think we're going to get
that's
banned.
The argument here, the argument is black people never do anything wrong, and that the entire system is all set up so against them that there is a massive conspiracy to frame black people for crimes.
Right.
Even when you have evidence of black people committing crimes, or like see black people committing crimes, that's all somehow a lie. All those people must be just be paid crisis actors by the evil white supremacy.
And I listen to this woman. I believe that this is I'm not sure if it's the mother or who, but I believe that this is a relative of the guy that was killed. If you're not going to do anything, sit your ass down.
Process to rewrite the rules on body cameras. How many people would show up to give input?
I Our problem is, there's no reason for that officer to have his body cam on. Point blank.
So, some of this is about the fact that the officer had his body camera off, which I understand. This is a legitimate, somewhat, it's a legitimate thing in a way. But let's break this down real quick, because this is important. Black Lives Matter pushed very hard to get body cameras, and a lot of police departments were like, okay, we're going to put body cameras on there. That way people could get video of an incident, and that way there wasn't all of this question. You need to understand, though, that they immediately regretted that decision, because those same activists, a lot of them started pushing back against body cameras as being a violation of the Fourth Amendment, because guess what it did when police departments started wearing those body cameras? It completely defanged their ability to go march in the streets and burn stuff down, because you would see plain as day, oh, the officer was right. Oh, the officer acted correctly. Oh, no, there's a gun in that man's hand. Oh, look, there's a gun in his pants. That happened a lot. Because they would still kind of try to stir it up. Then the video would get released and everyone would be like, nope, that guy was armed. Look, there's a gun right there. You can see it. He was reaching for a gun. He was doing this. He was doing that. So they lost a lot of ability to lie to people and get them angry and create racial tension in cities, which is all part of their political narrative. Mm-hmm. This is all about getting the Democrat Party in power by scaring black people into thinking that if a Democrat doesn't win, they're all going to be put back in chains. This is all part. This is so the unfortunate thing about this in some ways is these are people in a community that have been told that they're the targets of racism, that have been told that their police are out there hunting their kids down and murdering them, that they can't trust any white person, that every single white person is privileged and hates them because they live in a white supremacist country. That those people stand aside from the black clad acolytes who are there being funded by rich liberals. All of those other people are just bystanders being lied to constantly. And so they're standing there addressing a fake world that the liberal donors created for them. And so I feel bad for those people. I feel bad for the members of the community that are that only understand a reality that's just built on lies. But what's disturbing and disgusting about it is that there are these larger groups, literally $1 million donations going into advocacy groups whose entire job it is to try to create a race war in America so a Democrat can win the 2020 election.
Yeah.
That's real. You can see this plain as day. The activism from the top is all about scaring black people into thinking that America is racist, and the solution to America's racism is to vote for the Democrat.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they've set the stage for the only side that black people can vote for is the Democrat side, or else they're voting for racism, which will come and kill them and their families.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fear-mongering. And look at what's happening here. Like, look at how they muddy the waters. There's nothing in any of the news reports that discounts what the police officers at the scene said happened. There's nothing that discounts it. But what they're saying is, well, we don't have the video. We don't have the video. And the reason why they want the video is so they can edit it, so they can question it, so they can muddy the water.
I don't think they want the video. I don't think they want the video at all. I think they're simply using the lack of video to justify their claims.
Oh, okay. Sure. Yeah.
Oh, something negative happened to a black person and we don't have a video record of it. Good. That means that that the actions of that person can't be refuted easily. So now we have something we can make into a big deal.
Right.
If this guy had body cam footage, I bet we would never have heard about this case. Just like we don't hear about the dozens of other times people get shot by the cops, and there's body camera footage or security camera footage that totally exonerates the police.
Yep.
We don't hear about, we only hear about the ones that are ambiguous because people have an interest in making sure we have this perception that the cops are shooting black people. If we reported all of them, it'd be like, well, like, let's see, the last 100 times someone got shot by police, 99% of them had body camera footage that totally exonerated the police, and this, and only one of them didn't have any body camera footage, and really, so it's kind of maybe even in the air. All we have are witness statements that exonerate the police. They're only going to show you the 1% of times where there is no exonerating evidence, easily exonerating evidence of the police, and then use that little bit of uncertainty to make the case for mass racism.
Right. And that's the ploy. Yeah, they want that ambiguity. They want it bad. They need it. And speaking of, here's another great example that I have here. I'm going to pull this up, but unfortunately, I actually have to tell you, you guys may not recognize these people on this photo below here. Oh goodness, I'm sorry, Alan. I'm covering your face. I have to get the names right because it's fairly new. You probably heard of an author just now, by the way. Nobody knows who she is. She just popped up on the scene. Everybody acts like she's a well-known author, but she's not. E. Jean Carroll is her name, and she wrote a New York Magazine article, which just so happened to be an excerpt for her upcoming book, everybody, claiming that she was raped by Donald Trump.
Sure.
Yep. So claiming she once encountered – or so this was – the. So she made an accusation that Donald Trump sexually assaulted her. And this is the response that Trump like put out almost immediately regarding the story by E. Jean Carroll claiming she once encountered me at a Bergdorf Goodman 23 years ago. I've never met this person in my life. She's trying to sell a new book that should indicate her motivation. It should be sold in the fiction section. The president wrote, shame on those who make up false stories of assault to try and get publicity for themselves or sell a book or carry out a political agenda like Julie Swetnick, who falsely accused Justice Brett Kavanaugh. It's just as bad for people to believe it, particularly when there's zero evidence. Worse still, for a dying publication to try to prop itself up peddling fake news. It's an epidemic. Which, by the way, is awesome because he's talking about New York Magazine. Now, one of the other claims that was made here Trump put out that if anybody has any evidence of the Democrats being involved in this woman making these claims, to let them know immediately. Now, this photo that you can see down here on the screen for those listening to the audio version, don't worry, I'll explain it. This is a picture of E. Jean Carroll, the woman who just made the accusation. By the way, she says she's not going to pursue any prosecution. She just decided now that she would come out right before she's releasing her new book, come out and be like, oh, by the way, the president of the United States totally sexually assaulted me, guys. Totally now. Like all these other times that these claims came out, totally right now. It just happened. It's the weirdest thing that I just came forward while I'm getting ready to sell a book. Who she pictured
with? Why wouldn't we have heard about this during the campaign?
Because she wasn't ready, Alan. You don't understand how hard it is. You've never been a victim.
I guess I haven't.
Or empty platitude, because nobody was paying her yet. The person she's pictured with here below, Lisa Bloom. Now, who the hell's Lisa Bloom? Well, Lisa Bloom is an attorney. Lisa Bloom specifically is an attorney that works almost solely for Democrats and getting women that are part of sexual allegations against Republicans. It seems to be her bread and butter. That's what Lisa Bloom does. But specifically, Lisa Bloom is very notable because she was caught in 2016 paying women to make accusations against Donald Trump.
That sounds almost conspiratorial.
Yeah. But she was caught offering to pay women to make accusations against Donald Trump. There were women who came out and said, Lisa Bloom offered to pay my mortgage if I said Donald Trump sexually assaulted me.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow this woman hasn't been disbarred because she's part of the right political agenda. But once again, by the way, let me just reiterate something here. This is another episode of Christine Blasey Ford. And since I have a spine, and I'm logical, and because we call this the intersection of common sense and facts, for all of those people that wanted to not get yelled at during the Christine Blasey Ford thing, who said, I'm not saying that what Dr. Ford says happened to her didn't happen. I just don't think it was Brett Kavanaugh. That's a nice way of saying she's a liar. That is the most pathetic way of just be a man about it and say she was a liar. So because I'm an honest human being, Christine Blasey Ford lied. She was never raped by Brett Kavanaugh. It never happened. And it was completely contrived by the Democrat Party. This woman is lying, and it's completely contrived by the Democrat Party.
Yeah.
That's what's happening
here.
Pretty much. I just want everyone to acknowledge real quick that a political party in the United States of America is encouraging people to make false allegations of sexual assault against the president of the United States, and literally no legal recourse will be taken against them.
And in fact, half of your countrymen will cheer this person and outwardly proclaim they are 100% legitimate in their allegations.
Yeah. It is being normalized in society because of the Democrat Party. It is being normalized to make false allegations of sexual assault against somebody for power.
And that only works when there is another big group in society that is willing to take up that charge and help you prosecute them if it means hurting their political opponents.
Yes. Now, how do we know that the Democrat Party doesn't really care about these allegations, and the only reason why they're pursuing it is because it's Donald Trump and they get to whine and complain about Cheeto Hitler again? Well, that's easy, because the Democrat Party's not doing anything about Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax of Virginia, who has two credible sexual assault allegations against him, to include several people who at the time the assault occurred said that the victim confessed to them. That it occurred the day after. Or they don't care about what was his name? The guy who's the attorney general in Minnesota now? Used to be the vice chair of the Democrat Party. Oh, darn it. I'll remember his name. Give me a second. But who has at least two allegations of assault, where women were like beaten by him and dragged out by their hair and things like, nope, Democrat Party didn't want to do anything about that either. So we know that they don't care. Let's be honest. So Keith Ellison, that was his name. Dang it, man. I don't know why it slipped me. Probably because nobody cares about him anymore. But so anyway, the point is the Democrat Party doesn't actually care about sexual assault. They don't care about any of those things. They just see an opportunity, because that's the point. Remember, it's the animal backed into the corner. Well, the animal backed into the corner is going to literally try everything it can. And so now they're going to start marching out just a parade of women to lie, to try, because one of the voting blocks that they think will help